There's a lot of things in this old world that just do not make sense. Like why there's so few believers on the firing line, while so many others sit the fence. But if you want to know where the Word of God stands, and believe it wants to use your feet and hands, it's time to take your faith out of the seats and into the streets, and come along with me. If you only look, then you will see on WCN TV.
Welcome back. It's WCN TV, and we are broadcasting live. This is Tuesday, October 29th, 2024. Well, here we are, just 1 week away from Doomsday. Yes, Election Day. And I say Doomsday because we know from recent experience that it's going to be one of chaos. I don't believe it's going to be just for one day. No matter how the election turns out, I believe we need to be prepared for trouble, and we need to prepare physically and spiritually, not just for next week, but all the way into January and beyond, because, again, I don't believe there's going to be a peaceful transfer of power. But my advice is don't worry about it. Just know it's coming, prepare for it, and pray without ceasing for God's protection and instruction, and may His will be done. Today on the program, we have our good friend Alex Newman with us again. Alex is an intense researcher, writer, and one of the most sought-after speakers in the country. His resume is too extensive to list, but I'm sure you've seen him on various news outlets, in documentaries, or have read one or more of his books, or you may have met him in person at our Wisconsin Christian News conferences. He's a highly respected journalist and educator with a wealth of information on just about every topic we're faced with today. He's recently been following and reporting on the UN Summit of the Future and Pact for the Future. This is a giant global power grab that's on the verge of going into effect right now. We're going to discuss all of this and more with all of you today. So once again, as always, if any of you in our studio audience would like to ask questions or make comments during the program, just click that little hand button that you see on your screen, and I'll bring you into the show as soon as possible. And I do hope you'll participate with us today. It's going to be an important topic. Okay, so Alex, welcome. Thank you for being with us on WCN TV.
Great to be here. Thank you so much for having me, Rob.
You know, I actually wrote an extensive article on the UN a while back, and I went to look for it today because I was doing my show prep. Turns out I did this thing 5 years ago. I thought it was like a few months ago. Time flies, but if you would, let me just start by giving a little background, and then we'll get your input. So the UN has been around longer than I've been alive, officially launched in 1945 and headquartered in New York City since 1952. Before that, we had the League of Nations, which was formed after World War I. But in my entire lifetime, I can't recall a single thing that the UN has ever done anywhere in the world that's been positive. It seems like it's been a thorn in the flesh for the U.S. and the world as long as I can remember, always scheming for more domination and control. Maybe, Alex, can you give us a little background on this?
Well, I think that's a great starting point. You know, where did the UN come from? We were deceived. I guess we weren't. We weren't alive. But our ancestors, our parents, grandparents' generation was massively deceived by this, which right away kind of tells you where this is coming from, right? We know who the father of lies is. And so when they started this, I call it the United Abominations. I stole that, I think, from Megadeth. But when they started this thing, they told humanity that it was just about peace. It was just about security. You know, don't worry, there's no sovereignty issues here. We're certainly not setting up a world government. But behind the scenes, they knew very well what they were doing. And I think even just looking at a couple of the key players really gives the game away. So the United States government and the leadership of FDR, who at that point was essentially incapacitated. I mean, he wasn't really managing stuff anymore. He did have a bunch of Soviet agents in very high positions in his administration who were managing things. Harry Dexter White over at Treasury, George Marshall over at the State Department and the Defense Department. So he had a lot of Soviet agents around him. And the guy he decided to, or at least his administration decided to send to the UN conference that created the UN in San Francisco, a guy called Alger Hiss. They really, really liked him. And that should have been our first clue that something was fishy going on here. Red flag, no pun intended. They made him the chairman of the conference that wrote the UN charter. Then they made him the first secretary general of the United Nations. He also took all the delegates down to the Bohemian Grove, which maybe that's a story for another day. There's an excellent PhD thesis on that very trip. But Alger Hiss was huge. I mean, if there was one guy who could be the face of the creation of the UN, it was Alger Hiss. And Americans said, oh, look, we got an American doing this. This is great, right? And at that time, people were still thinking Uncle Joe, right? We weren't as concerned about the mass murdering butcher Joseph Stalin as we should have been. But just a few years later, we actually threw Alger Hiss in prison. We found out that he was a Soviet spy working for Joseph Stalin, not the American people who were paying him. So that was problematic right there. And he was one of many Soviet agents who were working on creating the UN. Then you had another guy, John Foster Dulles, who was a senior delegate. He actually served as Secretary of State. And he wrote a book published in 1950 called War or Peace, where he explained, I could probably pull the quote up here real quick. He explained in very clear terms that the objective of the UN was actually to create a one world government. And that was always the objective. Let me see if I can. Yeah, I got the quotes right here. And people can see that, you know, this wasn't really for widespread distribution. This was more for thought leaders, opinion molders. Very few regular Americans read the books that these policymakers put out. But here's what he said in his 1950 book, War or Peace. He said, the United Nations represents not a final stage in the development of world order, but only a primitive stage. Therefore, its primary task is to create the conditions which will make possible a more highly developed organization. He goes on, next paragraph, he says, I've never seen any proposal made for collective security with teeth in it or for world government or world federation, which could not be carried out either by the United Nations or under the UN Charter. So from the very beginning, we know they had an agenda for one world government. And from the very beginning, we know that communists were all over this thing, including representing the United States. And I think that is a really important part of understanding the UN, because we were told it was about peace. And the Soviets actually meant that. This is about peace. But you have to understand what communists mean when they talk about peace. They mean there will be no more resistance to our tyranny. Once we have slaughtered and imprisoned all of our enemies, then we will have peace. Very similar to what the jihadists mean, right? We want peace. Yep. After we behead all the infidels. So once you understand that the Soviets meant something very different than your average American did when they talked about peace, and that we had Soviet agents all up and down this process, and that they wanted to turn it into a one world government, you understand what the real objective here was: a one world totalitarian political, economic, and even religious system.
Well said. So this might be kind of a rabbit trail, but I think it's an important thing to mention. So the UN has 193 members representing nations from all over the world, and it's become an authority and a government unto itself, where some are more equal than others. For example, delegates to the UN have what is known as diplomatic immunity when they're on American soil. This means that delegates and ambassadors and their staff and family members can commit any crime from jaywalking to murder and still be immune from prosecution in American courts. They can't be arrested, nor can they be forced to testify in court. And the U.S. pays more than 25% of the bill for all this. So here we have this multi-tier system where these UN people seem to be able to get away with murder. am I correct on that, or is that?
You're absolutely correct on that, Rob. If people knew how bad it was, there would be outrage like you can't imagine. And let me just give you one example that I think will prove the point here. It's not just the diplomats and the representatives of governments that have diplomatic immunity. It's all UN staff, all UN officials from top to bottom, including their so-called peacekeeping troops, by which they mean their war-making troops. And the UN's war-making troops, by estimates provided by top UN officials based on the UN's own data, raped 60,000 women and children just in the last decade. How many were prosecuted? Zero. Why is that? Well, they all have diplomatic immunity. So, and this is not just like, you know, a bad apple goes off and rapes a child in some war zone. The stories I have seen, and I've been trying to sound the alarm about this my entire career in journalism, they will actually kidnap children, bring them onto these UN bases and pass them around to all the soldiers and pimp them out. It's the most grotesque, horrific stuff you can imagine. And then when they get caught, the people who the UN goes after are not the child rapists. It's not the pimps. It's not the kidnappers. It's the people who blew the whistle. And this goes all the way to the top, right? I'll give you an example. In the Central African Republic, the UN had a peacekeeping mission. This was probably about 10 years ago. And they got caught systematically raping children. And so there was an official at the UN Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights. His name was Anders Kompass. He was a Swedish man. And he tried to stop this. He said, hey, guys, did you realize they're raping children? This is not good. We need to do something about this. Oh, shush. Nobody wanted to hear about it. So finally, in desperation, he goes to the French government and to French prosecutors and says, guys, the UN's troops are down there raping children. You'd think somebody would care about that. Well, the French government did start asking questions. And so the UN Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, under the leadership of an Islamic prince, had Anders Kompass marched out of his office by armed guards, and then they had an emergency meeting in Italy, top leaders of the UN, all the major UN agencies, all the way up to the Secretary General, plotting on how they were going to demonize this guy and destroy his credibility so that the UN wouldn't look bad. No talk of how do we protect these children, no talk of how do we hold these child rapists accountable. It was all about how do we destroy the guy who blew the whistle and told humanity about this. And so it got so bad, Rob, I've got a lot of sources within the UN. I can count the number of journalists on my hand who report critically on the United Nations. So it's a very small community. And so I had been in communication with one of the top leaders of the UN, Undersecretary General for the OIOS, the Office of Internal Oversight Services. It's basically the internal UN policing mechanism, since no government is able to hold any of these people accountable. And very nice lady. Her name was Inga-Britt Ålenius, and she lived in Sweden. So she reached out to me one day, and we had been communicating by email for a long time. She said, Alex, we need to meet in person. So we met on an island in the Baltic Sea, talked for about 3 hours. She said, you know what? I don't even care if they know that I'm talking to you anymore. This is so sick. Anders Kompass should have been given a medal for trying to stop these monsters. Instead, he was treated like a criminal himself. So that's how bad it is. The crimes that these people are perpetrating would blow your mind. It's not just parking tickets. You know, everybody in New York knows the UN people. They just park wherever they want and they never pay parking tickets. This is not about parking tickets. This is about murder. This is about sex trafficking. It's about child sex slavery. It's about treason. It's about espionage. I can't tell you how many people on American soil right now are intelligence operatives and terrorists for hostile foreign powers, gathering sensitive intelligence on us, organizing and participating in political activities in our country, including protests and riots. It is so bad, Rob. We're only touching the tip of the iceberg here. It's insane. And the idea that they should be able to do this without even being able to be questioned by law enforcement, it is absolutely bonkers.
Absolutely. So the UN is supposed to be a peacekeeping organization, but while it has no military of its own, member states deploy military personnel to foreign countries at the direction of the UN, meaning that foreign soldiers often patrol the streets and cities of other countries. Case in point is Haiti, and it's just another example. UN soldiers from Jordan were deployed after the hurricane there in 2010. Rather than help rebuild the country or maintain peace, this UN deployment became a foreign invasion or occupation. Virtually no humanitarian aid was provided by the UN, and the country remains in rubble even yet today, 14 years later. And not only did the UN peacekeeping soldiers not help the people when the people peacefully protested them, UN soldiers opened fire on Haiti citizens with deadly force.
Yep. And this is not unique to Haiti. This happens all over the world, Rob, whether it's Mali, whether it's the Central African Republic, these peacekeeping troops. And by the way, they do serve under UN command. Yes, they're technically American troops, Russian troops, Chinese troops, whatever. China is now the biggest contributor to the peace forces, but they are under UN command. They are taking orders from a UN chain of command everywhere they go. They abuse the citizens. And this goes back to the very beginning. I mean, you look at one of their first major peacekeeping actions. This was in Katanga. This was the early 1960s. The people of Katanga, which was a province in the Congo, decided they were sick of having a mass murdering communist dictator ruling over them. And so they declared independence under the leadership of a great Christian man, a pro-America, pro-West Christian man named Moise Tshombe. And the UN determined in its infinite wisdom that this was a threat to international peace and security. And so they sent peace troops in there to force Katanga to remain part of this communist regime. And they started slaughtering civilians. They started bombing hospitals. They started raping innocent women. They started shooting at civilian cars as civilians were trying to flee the war zone to get away from these monsters. So this is a pattern, unfortunately, that goes back to the very beginning. It happened in Haiti. It happens everywhere. And so they abuse these people. And when these people finally can't take it anymore, they go out and protest. They go out and hold up signs. The UN comes in and starts shooting at them. And they say, oh, we have diplomatic immunity. Nobody can touch us. So and unfortunately, Rob, a lot of these peacekeeping missions are happening in lawless areas, places where there's no communications infrastructure. There's no proper law enforcement. So law and order is broken down, and these guys get away with some of the most horrific crimes imaginable. There's no peacekeeping here. It is it's just atrocity after atrocity if you look back at the history of this.
Well, and it makes me wonder if we're going to be seeing the blue helmets after the election and leading into January.
A lot of people say that's ridiculous, but I don't think it's ridiculous at all. You know, they're trying to stir up a civil war in this country. They would love nothing more than Americans shooting at each other, and that would provide the perfect pretext then for Russian troops, Chinese troops, Cuban troops, Venezuelan troops to come in and say, ah, look at you silly Americans. You democracy, a republic, whatever, it's so messy. It doesn't work well. So we're going to have to come in there now and help you guys. And, you know, there's very few ways that they can figure out to disarm America. We've got 400 million guns in circulation. That is one of the only viable alternatives that they have if they intend to disarm us. And we know they intend to disarm us because they say so regularly. So,
yeah. So let's kind of ease into this. So the UN agenda is 2021 and now, 2030. They've been coming at us for decades, but a lot of people have been indifferent because it's been all so far in the future. But before we get into the pact for the future, let's talk about some of the implications of Agenda 2030. They have 17 stated goals in that, and I would just like to go through a few of them. Goal number one is end poverty in all its forms everywhere. Well, to me, this means centralized banking systems, cashless currency, control of all finances, and the ability of you and I to buy and sell. Goal number three is ensure healthy lives and promote well-being for all at all ages. To me, this means mass vaccinations, whether you want them or not, government-controlled health care and death panels, forced sterilization, and forced abortions worldwide. Goal number four, ensure inclusive and equitable quality education and promote lifelong learning opportunities for all. This means we're going to be indoctrinated with UN propaganda from cradle to grave. Control not only of our public school systems, but also our social media, entertainment, and news outlets. And goal number five, achieve gender equality and empower all women and girls. Here we have forced acceptance and celebration of sodomy, pedophilia, transgenderism, and all manner of sexual perversion. By the way, in case you didn't catch it, empowering all women and girls is liberal speak for free abortion on demand. Other goals of Agenda 2030 include UN control of all water sources, control of food production, control of all private land, new UN taxes, UN control of the economy, private manufacturing and innovation, UN control of public transit, including determining who and where sovereign citizens may and may not be allowed to travel, not to mention Big Brother surveillance, not just in public places, but even through monitoring of our homes, cell phones, and computers. And of course, stationing UN soldiers from foreign countries to patrol and control the movements and activities of free citizens here in America and around the world. And as you said, it goes without saying they can't accomplish this without gun confiscation. So that is Agenda 2030, just in short. Anything to add, Alex?
Yeah, thank you, Rob. And so there's a lot to say about the 2030 agenda. I think one of only three or four journalists in the United States who reported on this as it was happening. It was almost radio silence for obvious reasons once you figure out what's in here. But the UN was very bombastic about this. The head of the UN General Assembly, Peter Thompson of Fiji, said this was the master plan for humanity. I'm saying, I bet God is having a good chuckle about that. Yes, the UN is going to come up with the master plan. And as you read this, the Secretary General of the UN at that time, it was Ban Ki-moon, he described it as the global declaration of interdependence. And don't think he didn't understand the significance of that. He knew very, very well what he was saying. They know that our foundational document in this country is our Declaration of Independence. That was the document that birthed America as an independent nation. So when the Secretary General of the UN says this is a declaration of interdependence, it's a very, very clear swipe at the independence of the United States. And as you read these 17 Sustainable Development Goals, it is essentially a recipe for global tyranny. And there's some stuff that to the uninitiated might sound appealing. We're going to solve global hunger. And so therefore, if you oppose us, then you want people to be hungry. We're going to solve global poverty, which means if you oppose us, then you want people to be poor. Of course, we know from Jesus that nobody's going to be solving global poverty until his return. There's a poor always going to be with us, at least until he comes back. But under the pretext of solving poverty and solving hunger, the UN is essentially demanding a blank check on your freedom. They're demanding a blank check on your wallet, on your bank account, and they're demanding a blank check on your nation's sovereignty. So they come up with these very nice sounding ideas, like we're going to take on hunger, poverty, climate change. And to do that, we need XYZ. So I'm glad you touched on goal number four, education. In my opinion, that is the central one for people to understand, because they know they're not going to get me, Rob. They're not going to get you. They're not going to get, the people Barack Obama called the bitter clingers who are clinging to their guns and their Bibles. The older generations, we're hopeless. We're lost. We're not going to come around no matter how much brainwashing they do. But they know if they can get our kids, then they can succeed over the long term. And so as you read goal number four, it's very explicit about what they're doing. It says that all learners, and that means all, right? Over and over again, they say, and they say, no one will be left behind. In other words, every last Indian in the Amazon rainforest, every last pygmy in the Congo, everybody is going to participate in this. All learners, it says, need to have the right tools to be able to promote sustainable development. And when they say that, it's very clear what they mean. It's not enough for you to just be brainwashed enough that you'll submit to this stuff. You have to be so brainwashed that you will beg for this, what they call sustainable development. And I'll come back to sustainable development in a minute. They go on to say in goal number four that this is going to include education on human rights. So when the UN talks about human rights, they mean the opposite of what we understand in this country as God-given rights, right? The Bible says that God said, thou shalt not murder. The Bible says that God said that thou shalt not steal. Therefore, God gave you a right to life. Therefore, God gave you a right to property. That's why our founder said God endowed us with unalienable rights. And the purpose of government, God says, is to punish evil. Theft is evil. Murder is evil. Therefore, government has an obligation to help you protect your rights. This has been the traditional historic understanding, not just in the United States, but clear back to King Alfred and the Magna Carta. I mean, this has been the Anglo-Saxon Christian understanding of freedom for at least 1,000 years, if not going straight back to Jesus Christ, because this is what's outlined in the Bible. So the UN flips that concept on its head. It wasn't God that gave you rights. I mean, you might be a Hindu. You might believe you came from a rock. You might believe that you came from a river. So you can't have God-given rights. In the UN's telling, the UN gives you rights. The UN Universal Declaration on Human Rights gives you rights. But go read it. Article 29, none of these rights and privileges shall be used contrary to the purposes and principles of the United Nations. Your rights and privileges can be limited for public order, morality, security, you name it. In other words, you have no rights. Okay. And if you look at the rights they purport to enshrine, you have a right to an education that furthers the activities of the United Nations, is what they say in Article 26. What kind of right is that? Does that mean I'm depriving my children of their right to education if I don't teach them the glories of the UN? I mean, that's what the text would suggest. So very, very dangerous. You hit also on the gender equality. That's also part of the education. When all the children need to be brainwashed to believe in gender equality, But when you read the UN's own documents on gender equality, they're not talking about what a normal American Christian person understands, right? That we are all one in Christ, that we're all made in the image of God, that we're all equal in that sense. They're talking about radical feminism, where you abolish all distinctions between mothers and fathers, you force women out into the workforce, you get the children in the government brainwash camps, you smash the patriarchy, as they like to say, which is just, you know, the biblical order of the family. So it is a bullseye on the back of traditional family, marriage, and morality. And it just keeps going on and on. They say all the kids have to have education in global citizenship. I don't even think I need to explain that. Right? They're going to brainwash your children to be world citizens. I don't want my kids to be world citizens, but that's what they say they're going to do. And they're very open, too, about the need for spirituality in education. Maybe we save that subject for later. And to go back just briefly to the subject of sustainable development, because that's the term that underpins all this, right? The 2030 agenda is called the Sustainable Development Goals, the 17 SDGs. We know what they mean by sustainable development. At one of their first major sustainability summits, this took place in Vancouver in the early 1970s, they put out the Habitat One report. And what they said in the Habitat One report, and I can actually pull that up real quick and even quote from it, they said that one of the things we need to do to have a sustainable world is get rid of private land ownership. Now, why would we want to do that? Well, because, of course, under communism, you can't have private land ownership. If you have private land ownership, you have freedom. You have a middle class. You have the ability of citizens to resist whatever the government is trying to impose on them, if it's evil or unbiblical. So actually, if you don't mind, Rob, I'll read real quick from that 1972 report, and people can see what the UN itself says they mean when they talk about sustainable development. And of course, there's a religious side to all this, too, that I hope we can get to. But Habitat One, this was the report that was put out by the UN after the meeting. It was their agreement. It's called the Vancouver Declaration. And they said land cannot be treated as an ordinary asset controlled by individuals. Private land ownership is a principal instrument of accumulation and concentration of wealth, therefore contributes to social injustice. Public control of land use is therefore indispensable. So you take that. You combine it with, for example, what it says in goal number 10, says we have to have not just national wealth redistribution, but global wealth redistribution. And it spells it out explicitly. We have to share the wealth produced in the world. That's another way of saying we have to steal from some to give to others. So it's very clear what they're up to when you read this. And it's kind of interesting that as soon as this thing was passed, the Chinese Communist Party came out using all of their propaganda organs, even their English language propaganda organs, and they celebrated the fact that they played in their telling of it a crucial role in formulating the 2030 agenda. Once you read it, it shouldn't be surprising to learn that one of the most murderous regimes to have ever existed in history was playing a crucial role in creating it.
And yet China seems to get a free pass when it comes to anything sustainable.
That's exactly right.
It's insanity. Before we get into the next topic here, anybody in the audience, questions or comments, now is your chance. If you want to raise your hand, we'll bring you in. I know it's kind of mind-blowing when you hear what's actually happening here, isn't it? So, okay, Alex. Excuse me again. I've got kind of a thing in my throat today. So if you would, tell us about this Pact for the Future, this Summit of the Future that's on our doorstep.
Sure.
I'm going to just let you talk and give you the show on this because this part is new and breaking right now. So.
Well, thank you, Rob. And one of the key things to understand about the Pact for the Future is that it aims to, in their terms, turbocharge the implementation of the 2030 agenda. The 2030 agenda, the sustainable development goals, are mentioned literally more than 100 times in this agreement. So it tells you what a foundational component of the UN's agenda, this 2030 agenda, is. But when you read the Pact for the Future, what's happening here is the mask is coming off. And a little background for the people who didn't follow this. I was actually there. I went to UN headquarters for the Summit of the Future. This took place at the end of September, so about a month ago now. And you had all the governments of the world, presidents, kings, prime ministers, dictators, potentates, princes, whatever. They all converged on New York City for the Summit of the Future. Not a word about this in the American media, I think, for obvious reasons once we get through this. But within the UN itself, this was portrayed as a huge deal. In fact, their marketing internally was, we're now transforming the UN. We're creating UN 2.0 was their marketing term. And I'm sure they did focus groups and all the rest of it. Now, they had these quotes from the Secretary General. They blew them up and put them in bubbles and their posters all over the UN headquarters. It was a quote from Secretary General Antonio Guterres saying, we can't build a future for our grandchildren with a system built for our grandparents. In other words, the old UN is no longer adequate. The UN that was just dealing supposedly with peace and security. Now we need a UN that's going to run education and the economy and the environment and the all the different areas of life that you can think of. And so I encourage people to read this document. It's not all that long. They actually tacked on two additional agreements to it and passed it by consensus, which means no government objected to it. And I can read it just a few quotes from here that people will understand what's going on here. These are direct from the Pact for the Future, again, agreed to by every government in the world. They said, we recognize that the multilateral system and its institutions with the United Nations and its charter at the center must be strengthened to keep pace with a changing world. Right there, they're telling you we're going to strengthen the UN. It says we renew our commitment to multilateralism and international cooperation. We're going to transform global governance and strengthen the multilateral system. So this isn't Alex Newman telling you this is a power grab. They are admitting in the text of this thing that they're going to give more power, more authority to these international organizations. They demand that all governments submit to the rulings and the decisions of the International Court of So-Called Justice, which is a kangaroo court, by the way. They say that none of these challenges can be addressed by a single nation. They can only be addressed through strong, sustained international cooperation. They say that this is not an option. It's a necessity. Right? These are just a handful of the highlights from this thing. They say that we need the future of our international order to continue evolving. And one of the things that really jumped out at me, And there's a lot of different areas that we could touch on. Education is mentioned dozens of times in there. But one of the areas that really jumped out at me, and I started focusing on this in early 2023, was emergencies. So I was sent by somebody within the UN a policy brief that was put out by Secretary General Antonio Guterres. A little background on him. He was the leader of the Socialist International before taking the top job at the UN. The Socialist International, if you're not familiar, is the world's largest alliance of socialist and communist political parties. It traces its roots directly back to Karl Marx, the satanic, godless monster who laid the foundation for the murder of hundreds of millions of innocent human beings, the brutal persecution of Christians across the world for a century. So that's where this guy is coming out of, right? Just to give you some sense of his background. And in this policy brief number two, it was part of the Our Common Future series, which was a preparation for the Summit of the Future. He declares in about 24 pages that he needs the power to be able to declare all by himself, mind you, no committee, no checks and balances, all by himself. He needs the power to declare global emergencies. And he lists examples of emergencies. There could be a climate emergency. There could be an environmental emergency. Could be a war, a conflict. It could be an economic crisis. It could be what they call a black swan event, something that we can't predict, so we don't even know what it could be. It might be something going on in outer space. With, you know, we can save that for another day. I suspect they're getting us ready for some big, huge hoax involving outer
anything,
space.
Basically anything that they declare is an emergency.
Exactly. Well, if the Secretary General feels like cow farts are an emergency, well, by golly, the UN needs to assume all power and authority over everything. So just to give people a sense, they even say specifically it doesn't actually have to be a global emergency, right? And when this is declared by the Secretary General, I can even get the exact quote here from the policy brief. It says, let me see if I can grab it here. It says, where did I put it? When the Secretary General declares an emergency, all nations, businesses, and sectors of society must recognize, and I'm quoting here, the primary role of intergovernmental organs, we're talking UN and UN agencies here, in decision-making. In other words, who's going to be the primary decision-maker when the Secretary General declares a global emergency? Intergovernmental organs. UN agencies. And so that was translated then into this final pact for the future, again, agreed to by every government in the world. And this is what they said. We recognize the need for a more coherent, cooperative, coordinated, and multidimensional international response to complex global shocks and the central role of the United Nations in this regard, which translated, that means we need the UN to lead the response to global emergencies. And it specifically says that the Secretary General must find new ways to strengthen the United Nations system response to complex global shocks. So what they have done here, Rob, and ladies and gentlemen who are viewing and listening, is they have given a mandate to the Secretary General. So now, if he declares, say, next week, an emergency, maybe a war breaks out, maybe Iran and Israel, maybe the Russians and the Ukrainians, maybe China and Taiwan, maybe it's an economic crisis, maybe the dollar collapses, maybe he determines it's a climate emergency, that we're going to cook the planet if we don't pay more taxes to the UN. If he determines that there is this emergency, he can now say, hey, everybody needs to obey me. And if you say, hey, what do you think you're doing? Who gave you that power? All he's got to do is point back to the Pact for the Future and say, look, I'm just doing what the nations of the world asked me to do. Here's the Pact for the Future. Read action item number 54. They told me I'm the one who should be leading the international response to international emergencies. So what are you going to say about that then? You have a problem with it? Take it up with Joe Biden.
Yeah. Is there a clause in there to opt out if individual nations decide they don't want to participate in these things?
It's very interesting that you asked that question, Robin. This is one of the things that didn't get as much attention as it probably should have. I suspect there's a little bit of narrative setting going on here. So as they were discussing this, right before it was approved, the Kremlin, and anybody who knows me knows I am no apologist for Vladimir Putin or the dictatorship in Russia by any stretch of the imagination. But the Kremlin submits an amendment and says, hey, we need to add this amendment that says that nothing in this pact shall be construed to allow the UN to interfere in the domestic affairs of a nation. And you'd think that'd be a no-brainer, right? I asked the spokesman for the Secretary General at a press conference about the criticism on sovereignty. So, oh, we're not building a world government, but we need one because there's all these international issues that only international cooperation can deal with. So the Russian government says we need this amendment. Six other governments join them. Some of the nastiest governments you'll find anywhere. North Korea, Iran, Nicaragua, Syria. I mean, it's a club of some of the nastiest dictators in the world. And so I think what they're trying to do here is, by the way, they did end up having a vote on it. And 140-something, I forget, I think it was 144, don't quote me on that, give or take a few, voted against that amendment. And only seven voted in favor of it. So that amendment was scooched off. And now the narrative is, if this subject ever comes up, when, say, the Secretary General wants to rely on action item 54 to be able to usurp power and authority, they'll say, hey, you can't interfere in the domestic affairs of our country. And he'll say, oh, no. The Russians submitted an amendment and that went down to defeat. So clearly the nations of the world, the governments of the world, meant for me to have these authorities. So very, very dangerous. The only government that did speak out loudly and clearly after allowing this thing to pass was Javier Milei in Argentina. He had some really, really strong statements. I don't know why his people at the UN allowed this to pass without objection. They should not have done that if they really believe what they say they believe about it. But that's the story. Every government in the world agreed to let this pass. The one effort to protect the sovereignty of nations from UN interference went down to a humiliating defeat. And then the Russians and the dictatorships allowed it to pass anyway.
And what did our American delegates have to say?
Oh, the Biden administration was cheerleading for this thing the entire time. I reached out to them in early 2023 to ask. I reached out to the State Department to ask, what is the administration's position on all this? And they said, oh, we're huge supporters. We're working with them. This is great. We love this. We need more international cooperation. We need more UN to deal with these problems. And I had reached out to the chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Congressman Mike McCaul, who is not, you know, a right-wing conservative Christian, whatever. He's kind of a milquetoast Republican based on his voting record back in early 2023. And he said, hey, this is really problematic. This is bad. We shouldn't be doing this. And so, you know, followed up with, well, what are we going to do about this? And, you know, silence. So he did put out, he did send me a statement after it was approved saying, we don't like this. It's not good. But you know, there it is. It's on record. And I did reach out to one of the premier experts on international law in the world. His name is Dr. Francis Boyle. He's a professor of international law at the University of Illinois. He used to teach at Harvard. His law degree in international law is from Harvard. He's number one in his class. He actually wrote the implementing legislation for the UN Convention on Biological Weapons, passed unanimously in both houses of Congress. He has represented governments and international institutions in all these international courts. He said, this is a treaty. This should be treated as a treaty. This has a binding effect on the nations involved, since the heads of state were involved in putting this together. And so it's hard to overstate the significance of all this. And yet not one in a million Americans could tell you anything about this because the media has been almost entirely silent on it.
So what you're saying is this is a done deal for us now?
Well, I mean, Donald Trump could come in theoretically and do what he did with the Paris Agreement, do what he did with the World Health Organization, do what he did with UNESCO, and say, we're done. You know, this wasn't ratified by the Senate. We're not going to consider it binding. But as long as we have somebody like Joe Biden or Kamala Harris or even, you know, the Bushes for that matter, you know, normal rhino milquetoast Republicans, they're going to treat that as if it is binding on our country. Now, is the UN going to invade us if we don't obey? Probably not right now. but do they consider
maybe in December?
That's right. If everything breaks down and chaos emerges, be a very good pretext for them. So, you know, right now they consider it to be a legal obligation on us. But do they have any enforcement mechanism if, say, Donald Trump comes in with support from Congress and says we're not playing along? No.
Okay. Russ had a question. Do you still?
I think I got it answered, Brother Rob. And Alex, my question, how difficult will it, if Trump decides he wants to get out of the UN, how difficult will that be? And can he have that defunded? How difficult would that be?
There's a lot Donald Trump can do on this front. He cannot on his own get us out of the United Nations itself. But very good news on that front. For the first time in our history, we have bills in both houses of Congress to withdraw from the UN entirely. It's called the Defund Act. And defund is a little bit misleading because it stands for the Disengaging Entirely from the United Nations Debacle Act. Nice name.
Really?
So it was introduced by Senator Mike Lee in the U.S. Senate. He is, of course, the senator representing the state of Utah. And then the House, it was introduced by Congressman Chip Roy of Texas. So this is the first time we have companion bills in both houses to get us out. Obviously, Joe Biden, to the extent that he's even doing anything at all anymore, is not going to be signing that bill. His handlers are not going to let him sign that bill if it passes. And it's probably not going to pass with Chuckie Schumer running things in the Senate. But if we had a really good election result in November 5th, we could see, hypothetically at least, that legislation move out of committee, move to the floor. It would be, I think, very difficult to vote against that, especially if you're a Republican. So if we have Republican majorities in both houses, it's going to be a lot of pressure. And Donald Trump can, even without that bill on his desk, he still can do a lot. And we saw that in the first time around. I mentioned a few of the things. Got us out of the WHO, got us out of UNESCO, got us out of the Paris Agreement. He actually slapped sanctions on the International Criminal Kangaroo Court, the ICC. Which, by the way, we're not even members of, although they like to pretend like they can prosecute Americans. He got us out of the UNRWA. He got us out of the UN Compact on Migration. So he was a one-man wrecking ball when it came to the architecture of global governance. And I guarantee you he will do it again if he's the president. And I've actually spoken with some of the architects of these policies during the first term. And they have told me on record, by the way, so I'm not revealing anything secret. They've told me on record that if and when he's back in the White House, we're doing this all over again, and we're going to take the kiddie gloves off. We're, you know, like with the Paris Agreement, we're not going to pretend like we have to wait 4 years to get out of this. It's over, right? It's done. We're not playing along with this hoax. So I do believe if he is elected again, unless we have been victims of the most monumental fraud in the history of humanity, Donald Trump is going to take aim at the institutions of globalism, and it's not going to work out well for the globalist establishment.
All right. So what is the... I guess my next question would be, what is the relationship between the UN and the World Economic Forum?
Well, there's a very deep and broad relationship between them, but they serve different functions. And so I'll explain it this way. Peter Drucker, the management guru, I think he used to pretend to be a Christian, but he trained up Rick Warren out in California. He's very, very closely associated with these elitists. And he came up with this idea for major global changes involving what he called the three-legged stool approach. And so he described this three-legged stool as a stool that needs all three legs to be able to stand. The first leg is the public sector, or you know, what we would call governments. That's the United Nations, right? You got all the national governments in the world within the UN. So when they pass a pact for the future or a 2030 agenda or whatever it is through the General Assembly, that's one leg of the stool. Then you have the second leg of the stool, as Drucker described it, is the private sector, the businesses of the world. And that's where the World Economic Forum comes in. That's really their raison d'être, if you will, reason for being, I guess it would be. And so in 2019, the World Economic Forum signed what they called in a press release and what the UN also called in a press release, a strategic partnership for implementing the 2030 agenda. And if you look at the scope of that, the primary function then of the World Economic Forum in this partnership was going to be to bring the business community to the table in implementing this 2030 agenda. Because they said it can't just be governments. It's got to be businesses as well. And so now how do they do that? Well, there's a lot of different ways that they exert pressure other than just, you know, peer pressure. Hey, you want to be part of the cool club, you got to do this. One of the obvious ways is you have a guy called Larry Fink. He's the head of BlackRock, one of the most wicked companies in the world, has absolutely ripped off taxpayers beyond anything you can imagine through their partnership with the Federal Reserve and the federal government managing the crises. Horrible ripoff of
America. If you look into it, they own almost everything along with State Street and Vanguard.
That's right. They are the largest or second or third largest shareholder in virtually every major publicly traded company you can think of. And that is easy to verify. Right? It's not our opinion. And the worst part is, Rob, they're using our money against us. So, you know, you go and you buy into an ETF, an iShares ETF. You go and you put your pension in with a money manager. And so they have your money, your pension, your 401k, and then they're voting your shares for you to remove directors who won't go along with the wokeness, to punish management if they won't do what they say. So Larry Fink is on the board of trustees for the World Economic Forum and also for the Council on Foreign Relations. And he's very open about what they're doing. He says behavior is going to have to change. And we here at BlackRock, we are driving that behavior change. And so they take our money, and they tell these companies, they tell the directors of these companies, look, you better start running more transgender advertisements. You better start reporting your climate emissions, or we're going to remove you from the board of directors. And there's going to go your nice little six-figure salary, and you're going to be disgraced. So a lot of these directors, they know this is not good for their business. They know this is not good for shareholders, but you don't want to go run afoul of Larry Fink. So that's where the World Economic Forum comes in. And then there's the third leg of the stool I'll mention just very briefly. Drucker described that as the religious side. And I believe this is one of the most important ones. And the UN believes this as well. They have now the Faith for Earth initiative. And so they have an organization now that I think most clearly represents the third leg of the stool. It's called Religions for Peace. And it's an organization I've been following now for a number of years. In 2019, they met in Germany. And they pretend to represent, by the way, all the religions of the world. I have the leader of this organization, Dr. Aza Karam, on camera saying that this is the UN of religions and we represent all the religions of the world. So I actually called my pastor. Hey, are we members of Religions for Peace? No. Right? So they have an explanation for that too. Anybody who doesn't want to join forces with them, you're extremist, you're a cult, you are, you know, if you say Jesus is the way, they've got a problem with you. So in 2019, Religions for Peace convened its membership in Germany, and they came out with a declaration that they all signed. They said that we commit to human development as set forth in the 2030 Agenda Sustainable Development Goals. So you've got the UN, public sector, World Economic Forum, private sector, Religions for Peace, religious sector, all marching in lockstep toward this one world political, economic, and religious future based on these ideas that really, I think, come from the pit of hell. We're talking doctrines of demons here.
Okay. So just to be clear, this UN Pact for the Future has been signed. It's done, right?
Yes. Yes, it is.
We are signed onto it now. And, yes. Okay. So how do you see that impacting us here in the coming months and years?
A lot's going to depend on what happens with the elections here. We have several encouraging things happening. We have, and I did an article about this at my website, we have 26 American governors. I don't know, hardly anybody reported this, but 26 governors signed an open letter to Joe Biden and to the world saying we are not going to be obeying UN recommendations, decrees, policies, whatever. We're just not going to do it. The federal government doesn't have these authorities. So clearly the federal government can't delegate authorities it doesn't have under the Constitution to an international organization that we didn't elect and we don't support. So half or more of the nation's governors have already publicly gone on record saying, we're not going to obey these things. Not the Pact for the Future specifically, they were addressing the World Health Organization, but the same principle applies to all these right. different areas. That's really encouraging. We've got more and more states now passing laws protecting the people of those states from these attacks on our sovereignty. Most recently, we had the state of Louisiana voted overwhelmingly to ban UN influence and meddling in the public health decisions of their state. We've got sheriffs all over this country who've gone on record saying we will not allow the enforcement of any of this goofiness within our jurisdiction, within our counties. So they've got a real problem when it comes to the United States of America, and they know it. They're very concerned. We are really the last bastion of resistance. And so what happens on this November 5th election is obviously going to play a really significant role. If Kamala Harris is able to cheat and get back into office, they are going to quadruple down on this stuff. They're going to go full speed ahead. They're going to open up the border. They're going to give amnesty to the illegal immigrants so that we can never have another Republican victory. They're going to surrender as much sovereignty as they can get away with as quickly as possible. They're going to dismantle our economy as quickly as possible and make us subject to this new world order that they're building. If Donald Trump wins, I wouldn't regard it as a solution to the problem. I think a lot of people are putting their hope and trust in Donald Trump, their hope and faith in Donald Trump, when their hope and faith should be not in princes, not in men, but in Christ alone, right? So we have to make sure that we don't fall into another trap, which is, you know, putting all our hopes and faith in Donald Trump. I think he would be orders of magnitude better, and he would put the pause button on all this. In fact, I think he would set them back maybe by decades, but ultimately we're not dealing with a problem that can be solved politically, right? If you look at this, and they've understood this for a long time.
Politics. You said that because I just broadcast today a commentary called "There Is No Political Solution."
Yeah, well, it's nail on the head right there. They realize that politics is downstream from culture. And they also realize that culture is downstream from education. So they control education. They control culture. The idea that we're going to be able to use politics as a lever to stop them is almost self-evidently ludicrous. They've got 80 to 90% of our young people in indoctrination camps where they're learning to beg for this global tyranny as we speak. So this is not something that we can just elect a president and go back to sleep and go back to watching the Super Bowl and think, yeah, Donald Trump's going to save us. Again, I like Trump. I disagree with him, obviously, on some significant issues. But I think what he will do, it's kind of the equivalent of applying a tourniquet, right? Right now, we've lost a leg and we're bleeding out and we're going to die if we don't deal with this. Donald Trump can come in and apply a tourniquet, stop the bleeding for the moment while we figure out, all right, what do we do here, right? How do we stop this from becoming a deadly problem? Whether we will take advantage of that time if we get it, that's a whole nother question. We didn't really do it in 2016. You know, it was nice to have a little break from the globalism, the constant expansion of government. But what did we do? Christians, conservatives said, oh, yay, Donald Trump's in charge. We can go back to sleep. We can go back to doing what we did before. And of course, now we're in a much worse position than we were in 2016. So a lot will depend on this upcoming election. But over the long term, a lot more is going to depend on God, the church, parents, and what we do when it comes to raising and discipling our children, when it comes to what we do in terms of speaking out, resisting the evil culture that is all around us. And I think over the long term, those things are going to be much more important than who wins or doesn't win the next election. So,
yeah, my opinion is I do not believe they're going to allow Harris to win. I believe they're going to have they're going to select Donald Trump this time for the sole purpose of creating havoc and chaos and more burning, looting, rioting. And in fact, just today, there was an article that came out that said the left has vowed basically to violence if Trump wins. So, I mean, it's the perfect excuse for them to do what they did the entire time of his first term, and just only on a much worse scale. And now they have the illegal invaders in place and ready to attack. And now we have this pact where the UN can come in and be so-called peacekeepers to it all. But I see terrible chaos coming our way.
Yep. And the World Economic Forum started talking last year. I don't know that they ripped off the term from, I borrowed it from Pat Wood, the term polycrisis. But they started warning in 2023, early 2023, January, if I'm not mistaken, about the coming poly crisis and how afraid should we be? And the short answer is you should be terrified, so terrified that you'll give up all your freedom and your sovereignty and all the rest of it. So I think what you just said is a very, very real prospect. I think they would like to see Kamala Harris in office, but I think at this point they may have resigned themselves to the fact that that's not going to happen, in which case they will try to destroy the country once Trump gets in and then use Trump as the guy to blame, right? Oh, Americans elected a conservative, a guy who believed in free markets, a guy who publicly professed Jesus Christ, and look what happened. The whole country fell apart and descended into total chaos. The economy was destroyed, et cetera, et cetera. So we'll see. We'll see what happens with that. I'm actually very concerned, and I'm just speculating here. I don't have any kind of insider knowledge or anything like that, but I'm concerned that the evildoers might even try to attack Kamala Harris in a physical sense, you know, maybe an assassination attempt or something, and then blame right-wing MAGA terrorist extremists and use that as a pretext to then bring in all sorts of crackdowns on free speech, on freedom to organize, et cetera, et cetera. So I think there's a lot of possible scenarios here. None of them are going to be easy. There's no scenario here in which we're just going to be able to go back to life as normal.
Well, you know, some that are more dangerous than others. The media has constantly asked Trump if he will concede if the immediate results show that he lost, and he has said he will not. And they've asked the same of Harris, and she said she will not. But when it comes down to it, I do believe Trump's going to win. But then it comes down to certifying the election, and who is in charge of certifying the election? It's going to be Harris. The vice president certifies the election. So how is that going to go? I mean, are we looking at an insurrection or something? You know, I'm just thinking here.
Yep. And I think we all should be in prayer about these, because we know what they planned last time, right? We looked at the Transition Integrity Project funded by George Soros, led by the disgusting pervert Podesta brothers. We know what they were plotting. In the only scenario where they had a clear, unequivocal Donald Trump win that they couldn't stop, well, what were they going to do? They were going to send out the terror mobs to burn down our cities. They were going to have California, Oregon, and Washington threaten to secede from the Union unless we could blow up the Electoral College. So there's no way that, you know, the election comes and goes and Trump wins and, oh, everything's great, right? That's just not going to happen. So we should be preparing ourselves for some real serious turbulence here. We should be in prayer. We should be ready to serve our neighbors in the event that things get really crazy. And I do think that they will throw crisis after crisis at us in an effort to completely destroy our country and pave the way for the emergence of this new world order. So,
okay, before we run out of time, I want to have you tell us about your new book, Indoctrinating Our Children to Death.
Well, thank you, Rob. I appreciate it. So this is it right here. It's available through Amazon. And it is about, it starts off with the history of the government school system. A lot of people don't realize that the people who created this system, their main objective, according to a whistleblower, was to destroy Christianity, to eliminate Christianity. So when we talk about fixing the schools, we're addressing the wrong issue. And so I go through that whole history. I prove why this was created. I show you where it's going, right? The UN is literally seizing control of education around the world, using it to prepare children all over the world for a future totalitarian global economic, political, and religious order. And you can prove this very simply. I've got the documents. I've got the books in my office. And then I also go back in time to what education looked like before the government took it over. You know, what kind of education produced the men and the women who created the United States of America? So we go into that. What does the Bible teach on education? And very honored that we've had some really great endorsements. Kirk Cameron, of course, the actor, General Michael Flynn, National Security Advisor to Donald Trump, Pete Hegseth, co-host of Fox and Friends. We've got a lot of incredible people who have endorsed this book. Tina Deskovich, co-founder of Moms for Liberty, Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North. And I didn't expect it, actually. I sent out endorsement requests to about 50 people, and we got back, I think, 47. So that was really encouraging. I think people are finally starting to understand that this is the key issue for family, for faith, for our churches, for our country. And it's a lot of information that you're not going to find anywhere else. And so I do hope people will at least familiarize themselves with the information.
And can they get that on your website, libertysentinel.org?
Yes, they can. Yep, there's a store button there, so they can click on the store button, and okay, I will send them a signed copy. Obviously, it takes me a lot longer than it does Amazon, so if people want it tomorrow, you have to go to Amazon. But if you don't mind waiting a little longer, I will send you a copy with a signature on it, and you can get a whole bunch of other stuff that we've done there, too, other books, DVDs, and things like that.
All right, good. I'm gonna need a signed copy.
So, be happy to send you one, sir.
For my collection of Alex Newman books. You can also find Alex at thenewamerican.com, by the way, where he's senior editor, or libertysentinel.org. So we are just about out of time. Thank you, Alex. I really appreciate all the information. It was very enlightening for me, and I thought I knew what the UN was all about, but now you have enlightened me and all of us. So thanks for being here.
Absolutely.
Next week, we'll be broadcasting live on Election Day. Dr. Mike is going to be hosting while I'll be putting together the new edition of Wisconsin Christian News. I'll be back as soon as possible, and we're going to be talking with guests directly from North Carolina and Eastern Tennessee about what's going on there and the situation with FEMA. So until then, God bless you. We'll see you soon.